Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
TRE in the afternoon, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good afternoon. It's just gone 5:05. You are listening to Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Steve Holmes and Percy Rowland. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you both for coming in. If you are listening at home and you'd like to get involved, you can. Here's how.
To contact TRE, please call 952 78 4000. Email studio at tre.radio. Send us a WhatsApp on +34 645 99 67 95.
I came across an article all about pineapple on pizza and realise it was a controversial one. Although, interestingly, a survey done a few years ago in 2021, 44% of Americans said they enjoyed pineapple on pizza and 41% were firmly against it. So it's pretty evenly split. It does seem to be a dividing subject. So pineapple on pizza, have you ever done it? Would you ever?
Definitely not my favourite. So it wouldn't have been my first choice, that's for sure. And looking at the survey, it sounds like it's a bit of a sort of Marmite situation.
Definitely.
You either do or you don't. There's no in between.
So have you had it before?
I've had it before, yes, but not to describe, where they're describing it though as a pizza, a pineapple base and lots of pizzas. Lots of pineapple in there, not for me.
No.
Percy, come on.
You're having a deep think about this.
I was waiting for a question. No, I think the key to your question is in the survey that it was done in America. I think it depends on where you do it. If you did it in Italy, the result would be slightly different.
For sure.
If you as much as mention pineapple on pizza, they will attack you with pizza forks.
Yes.
No, it's a strange one because I do enjoy... Personally, I do enjoy kind of sweet, savory dishes. In Asian cooking, you have them a lot. You know, when you have, for example, in Thai cooking, you have a lot of dishes with pineapple, and they're delicious. And it works. But for some reason, pineapple on pizza doesn't really work. I mean, it can. I don't know. It's just not really pizza. It's something else.
It used to be my go-to many years ago. I'm talking 20, 25, 30 years ago, it used to be the pizza that I ordered. I would have a Hawaiian.
Careful what you admit to in public.
I really used to like it, but I haven't ordered it or tried it for many, many years, just because I know there's so many other things that I prefer. But if I was at a pizza buffet and there was Hawaiian pizza, I'd go, oh, Hawaiian pizza. I haven't had that in a while. And I'd have a slice and probably like it. But in terms of ordering a whole pizza, I'd rather have a mushroomy, truffly, posh one.
Yeah, I think pineapple and cheese is not something that rolls off the tongue too well. And I think, you know, from a New Yorkshire point of view, you would have cheese and apple, but not cheese and pineapple.
You know, funny enough, on a cheese board, you know, you often have, and it works with certain cheeses, you can have pineapple with it.
Yeah, gorgeous one they do in Mercadona, the soft cheese.
Also.
Really, that's pineapple. That's nice. And what about the 70s, the cheese and pineapple sticks? We had that when we did Abigail's party. We had to make that. That's quite
nice. Not everything that they did in the 70s is necessarily recommended for...
I'd like to say I don't remember it, but I do.
But, you know, it's funny, you know, you know, I do a bit of debating and so on. And a few years ago, I was at an event and I did a workshop on debating. And one of the exercises I did was Devil's Advocate. So I asked the question, you know, who here likes pineapple on pizza? And there were like two or three brave hands that went up and admitted to it. So I asked one of them up. And then I asked one of the other people who said, absolutely no way, I hate pineapple on pizza. And then I made them state the case for the opposition. So the one who loved pineapple on pizza had to tell us why it was awful.
And the
one who hated it had to say why it was amazing. And there's the power of good public speaking and persuasion. In the end, everybody voted in favor of pineapple on pizza.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, amazing. amazing because they did such a good job selling it.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Clever. And they didn't even like it themselves.
No. And so ever since when I hear pineapple on pizza, I have to think about that. I think, oh, you know, that's a good exercise.
Yeah.
You know, also how politics work and how we end up with things we don't really like, but if somebody makes a good case for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the idea of Thai food and how there are other cuisines where you have sweet and sour goes really, really well together. So once you start thinking about that, it's not so crazy, is it? You've got the saltiness of the ham and then the sweetness of the pineapple. It proper, makes sense.
Proper sweet and sour pork should have pineapple.
Yes, exactly.
And it's divine, and it's not the same without.
Mm, there you go. Okay, dancing in the kitchen. When Sophie Ellis-Bextor put out her online kitchen disco shows during COVID, she may have been onto something more than a spot of lockdown lambada. But Miss Ellis-Bextor, who's continued the concept on her own Radio 2 show, also seems to have ushered in a fun fitness trend that can be as effective as going to the gym or out for a run. Researchers have found that you can achieve the recommended amount of weekly exercise simply by dancing in your kitchen for 20 minutes each day. Would you? Do you? Have you?
Music in the kitchen, definitely. Especially if I get charged with making dinner or you know, whatever, then the music's on. Dinner's not always successful, but the music's pretty good.
But you're entertained.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you ever have a bit of a dance?
Well, you know, not that I would own up to, you know, but, you know, you never know.
Has been known. Do you dance in the kitchen, Percy?
Depends on how much wine I put in the food or yes. into myself while I'm cooking. No, not really. I love, as you said, I love cooking with food, with music. And I like to, funny enough, I like to match the music to what I'm making. So, you know,
nice.
If I cook Indian, I put old Bollywood music on. And sometimes, you know, they really are, they get you wiggling away. You know, you're not even noticing.
Exactly. You're not planning to.
Yeah.
I don't really do this much. I always have music on in the kitchen or in the house if I'm cleaning or, you know, if I'm doing any kind of task that I don't need to concentrate on. There's absolutely no way that I could have music on if I'm preparing a quiz, for example, or doing any kind of work where I need to concentrate on words or numbers. I can't have the television or the radio or music on when I'm concentrating. But if I'm doing something that doesn't require a lot of concentration, then definitely I'll have music on. But I love to dance and I love music. So, yeah, I should do this.
But now you just need to cook.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very much in fashion as well at the moment, isn't it? On the news for dancing and keeping fit and the Angela Rippon effect, you know?
Yes.
That everybody's sort of... and we're in a sort of a pre-Strictly Come Dancing moment, aren't we, at the minute?
Yeah.
So everybody's sort of getting ready for that one, I guess. So
definitely.
I
do Zumba classes quite regularly, which is dancing. And it's, you know, whenever we talk about exercise, the key experts always say is to find something that you love, that you don't think of as, you know, a chore, or I've got to go to the gym now, or I guess I better have my daily walk. If that's how you feel about it, then you're unlikely to keep it up. It's finding some, you know, there are people that would, I know people who hate dancing who would never do a Zumba class, and that's fine. You've got to find something that you love. And dancing, that works for me. So I should do it more at home and save money on the class, shouldn't I? Photographs. Printed photographs are making a comeback thanks to young enthusiasts. A recent survey found that 43% of aged 18 to 27 years old print pictures around four times a year. This is double the amount of older generations. Can you remember the last time you printed a picture and why?
No, printing one off, definitely not. Having old photographs, thousands of them.
Do you get them out and look at them?
Yeah, okay, and again, yeah. And you open the shoebox that's under the bed or whatever, and you look at the old photographs, and you look at yourself when your hair was black, you know, and you only had one chin. It's a great experience, isn't it? I mean, if you remember the day of taking a film to the chemist to get it developed, you know, and then getting the pictures back and finding out, out of 24 pictures, three of them were good, the rest of them were rubbish, you know.
And I find find it funny and fascinating that so many people, I mean, I know we tend to do this with nostalgia, but look back on those days as if they were better. But when you phrase it like that, how is that better, you know, than taking pictures digitally, seeing straight away, oh no, that's blurred, or oh no, you've got your eyes closed, or oh no, someone just walked in front, let's do it again. You know, we can create so much better photos, on our phones that we have in our handbags, pockets, whatever. We don't need to take big cameras around with us. And it's just so easy, isn't it?
It is. But can you imagine your sort of kids or grandkids looking at digital photographs of the grandparents? And it's not going to happen, you know?
No,
you
like, not
look
as
at
much.
Pictures now of my grandparents and stuff like that. Mm. The black and white photographs, no, they would never see those.
No.
You know, because they're on your phone and you've got rid of them, you know?
Although I do love a Facebook memory that pops up with the photos.
Yeah, I'm not big on social media, so...
I think what you just mentioned is something to do with you're absolutely right. The quality of pictures we take actually is so much better than what we could do in the past. Okay, let's say for 90% of people, if you were a photographer, if you are a photographer, you still, a lot of photographers use iPhones, but also use digital
proper cameras.
And there's been, you talked about this, that it's young people who are very keen on printing pictures, and they also, there's like this whole trend of anything vintage.
Yeah.
So they love using vintage cameras, you know. And you do get, if you know what you're doing, you get a different quality, obviously. But for the majority of us, it's absolutely true. But we take so many of them that it's devalued. You know, back in the day, you took 50 pictures. Now I take 500. I constantly have to delete stuff from my phone because I'm out of memory. I've got 14,000 pictures on there. That's like from the last 2 years. Okay, also stuff that people send me. And I never delete anything.
Can you imagine the cost of getting those done at the local chemist?
I'm paying enough for Google storage. Just because. But, you know, I hate deleting things because, okay, at some point I have to delete it from my actual phone. But I find that, you know, sometimes you try and find something. I've never deleted an email, basically, unless it's spam. And, you know, occasionally you have this. Do you remember such and such? Like the other day we had, I can't remember what it was, something we wanted to find out from 8-9 years ago. One search in Gmail and it came up.
Wow.
In my 27,000 emails or however many there are.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it? And I love... I do enjoy looking back over photos, and it's handy, you know, it's depending on the phone, obviously, but it's quite handy to be able to find stuff. You know, you can scroll back through the months, or you can click on the particular year to make it quicker and easier to find.
The other day, I dug out my old phones, and I used to, now you don't have it anymore. You don't have the memory card in it, you know, but back in the day you had, okay, however much gigabytes of storage, and then you would put in an SD card and you could expand your storage. And then at some point I would change phones and the little card was left there. And not all of them were backed up on Google. So I have a gap of several years actually on Google Photos. And the other day I went through all the, and even the old phones, I charged them to see what's still on there.
Oh, yeah.
And I went back through, I didn't even know from which years initially, you know, what I would
get. What you were going to find.
What I was going to find.
Who you were going to find.
And it was interesting. There's thousands of pictures there still, and which I want to back up at some point.
It's really difficult. I don't know if you've ever done this, gone through physical photos and worked out what to throw away and what to keep. My dad and I have done it multiple times in the last few years since mum passed away. You know, we had loads of photos from since I was born, you know, particularly, you know, me growing up and all family holidays and things like that. But then photos from my dad's youth, from my mum's youth. We also had photographs from my mum's parents that you know, and you can accumulate a massive amount of, I mean, we had two big boxes. Once we scaled it down, this was before we scaled it down more and more, big boxes full of photos. And you're going through them all, and you know, we sort of made a decision that if you can't see anybody's face and you don't know where the photo has been taken, then you could get rid of it. You know, you're looking at a photo with some trees in a forest, and unless it's an amazing photo that takes your breath away, and you're kind of going, what is that? What can you remember? You know, and you're trying to work out where it, do you need to keep it? Probably not. Or a photo that is slightly blurry or not a particularly flattering photo of some, you know, you had to give yourself these rules. And we got rid of a lot because it was just too much. We wanted to keep photos that would be nice to look back on and go through again. And if it wasn't a photo that was a nice one or to look back on.
Have you put them in an album or are they still in the box?
Oh, no, they're in the box, but they've got dividers. We've put them into years. We kind of organise them so... But there are some that you don't know the year, you know. I'm looking. We're looking at a picture of me and I'm going, am I four? Am I seven? I don't really know, you know.
I have thousands and thousands and thousands still in not organised. In my dad's old place, and they are a lot. Most of them, I mean, you know, my dad was 61 when I was born, so that you know, obviously, most of the pictures were from before I was born.
Yeah,
a lot of them in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
A lot, and even you know, going back to my grandparents and so on before the war and everything. And for me, the biggest challenge is just to recognize people in the pictures. I mean, I recognize my father, and it's funny, you know, like in his youth, he looked a lot like me. So it's like, oh, is that a picture of me? Oh, no, it's not. And but then, you know, there are so many pictures. Most of the pictures, some of them, I can guess who those people are, even though I didn't know them. But most of them, I don't. A lot of women.
So
I mean,
an amazing diary,
for some reason.
Though, isn't it? It's an amazing photo diary.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in black and white. I think black and white photographs and black and white movies are... Great.
And they're
They're intriguing and you know,
and they're fascinating because so many of them are from exotic places like India and Africa and so on. There's all these black and white photographs with elephants and so on. And my father somewhere in the middle in a suit, you know, in a business suit as you traveled in those days.
Yeah,
and it's fascinating. So I can't throw any of that away. I just at some point I want to have the time to organize it and really do something with it.
Yeah, it would
but
be nice to put more of them in albums.
It's a project.
Yeah. But again, it's the storage of all the albums, isn't it? That's you know, if you're putting thousands and thousands and thousands into albums, that's a lot of albums.
It's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time, it's a lot of albums, and you'll probably want to write things as well. It's massive project. It's one of those that you need to kind of have a month off work, not see anybody else, and just stay in and do it, because otherwise it's one of those things that just won't get done otherwise.
With some music on in the background.
Put some music on, absolutely, the right kind of music. We better take a break.
Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Now, we welcome back to Men Talk with me in the studio, Steve Holmes and Percy Rowland. There is an article here that made me chuckle for various reasons. So I'm going to read part of it out. So it has a picture of Britt Ekland, allegedly, in the nude, showing, so from behind, showing her bottom, although there's a sticker over the bottom, obviously. And it reads, "It's a moment that would have been many a teenage boy's first glimpse of on-screen nudity as Britt Ekland's character danced naked to seduce a policeman in The Wicker Man. Yet the scene from the classic 1973 film has now been given a trigger warning as woke university bosses fear it may be too much for today's sensitive students. The movie is on the syllabus of a master's degree in folklore at the University of Hertfordshire, but students on the course, typically aged over 21, have been told they can skip it if they are worried about the depiction of nudity. Last night, the Swedish actress, age 82, branded the decision absurd. She said, "In 52 years, I've had many comments from men that was their first experience of seeing someone of the opposite sex without clothes. I have never, ever had a comment saying, 'You disturbed me for the rest of my life.' I doubt any young person in their 20s will be shocked or dismayed or unable to function for the rest of the day or week or month because they are watching The Wicker Man with 1 minute of me nude." So there's a couple of points here. I want to talk about what she's saying, but also I have a little bit of inside information because my father was in The Wicker Man. He did all the drumming, all the percussion and things that you hear on the soundtrack is him. And that naked scene wasn't Britt Ekland. It was a stripper from Walthamstow.
I was going to rush home tonight and watch that Wicker Man.
Oh, it's still very good, but it's not her. Apparently, Britt didn't want to show her bottom, so they got a body double in. So anyway, that's just a little bit of inside knowledge. But you know the scene, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Very famous scene.
Yeah, it was a good movie, actually.
Really good film.
Quite intriguing, yeah.
Really good film. Yeah. So do we think this is madness, or is there a place for, oh, no, you know, we need to be careful with... You don't see the front, you literally just see the back.
Exactly, no. I understand why that would be disturbing. I mean... I mean, the 21-year-old students who will be exposed to this have been watching porn on their phones since they are 11.
Oh, don't!
And
they
would be absolutely shocked that there is nothing more happening. So
yes.
Obviously they will be disturbed.
Mm, yes, that's why they would be disturbed, because that's all they're getting. Yeah, exactly. It's foolish and silly and ridiculous to think that 21-year-olds are going to be disturbed by seeing a naked bottom, isn't it, really?
There are times where I wonder whether these things are made up just to cause artificial outrage over how ridiculous is this decision. But then you investigate it and it's actually true. It's like we live in a world where it's no longer possible to tell, you know, what is real and what is satire. Well, you know, you would say you'd see something that's The Onion or, you know, some satirical magazine making it up. And then it's like, no, this was just published by, I don't know, Trump or someone in power or whoever it is. I mean, it's madness is no longer relegated to one side or the other. It seems like a collective state.
Mm. I'm not a fan of trigger warnings in general,
oh, no.
To be honest.
No.
I feel like they're branded about far too easily.
Yes.
You know, you can go to the theatre now. And when we went to the theatre to see Abigail's Party when we flew back last year, there were warnings that there were scenes of smoking, and occasional swearing.
You get that on Netflix,
and,
don't you? It comes up scenes of smoking.
And
what's
it's
all
like,
about?
Come on, there's people smoking in the street.
Yeah.
You know, I guess there is a... I understand trigger warnings when it's the kind of thing that can be really disturbing or shocking, you know, scenes of an abortion taking place or a rape or, you know, scenes
extreme
that...
Violence
extreme
like
violence. Yeah. Something that could literally trigger something because it's something that they've been through and, you know, could give them nightmares or whatever.
Something you really don't want to be exposed to.
Yeah, exactly. So I do think there is a place for it, but for trigger warnings over, semi-nudity or smoking,
know,
or...
It's on every... If you watch a show on Netflix, you know, or movie or whatever, you get all those things in the beginning on the top of the screen. It's usually swearing, nudity, smoking, drug use, alcohol use, etc., etc.
Yeah.
So every time, you know, my girlfriend and I would watch it, it's like, oh, yes, this is a good movie. We want to watch it.
This is the one for me.
It's got all the things we like.
And it's usually pretty tame, actually, when you've watched it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Where they got that from?
But I mean, alcohol use again.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just bizarre to warn people of that. Drug use, I guess, I get maybe to a point. You know, if it is depends what the drug use is and how it's done. You know, I get.
You don't go into a movie completely blind, though, do you? You've got an idea what you're going to see anyway.
Yeah.
You know,
and I think I would have thought that most of those things would be put in place for children, but then it goes back to the fact that if it's a PG film or a 16 or an 18, they shouldn't be watching it anyway.
Yeah.
But for all those warnings to be in place for grown adults, I find strange. You know, if you are going to watch a film, most people, you know, even if you're looking on your television and it tells you like two sentences as to what it's about, you make a decision on those two sentences. And if it says it's really violent or it's gang related or it's a rom-com or whatever, you go, oh, I don't really fancy that.
Yeah, I mean,
that
Wicker Man movie would probably have a warning that says nudity and there's just one.
Exactly.
They probably have all sorts of warnings on it.
Yes.
I mean, there's a human sacrifice in it. Maybe you'd want to warn us about that. But it's the same as, you know, warnings on coffee cups saying, careful, hot, or whatever. Like, what do you expect? I hope it's hot. It's coffee. You know?
Oh, it is silly. It does annoy me. It makes it kind of
or
makes
like a pack
me
of,
chuckle.
A pack of nuts that say it might contain traces of nuts. I bloody hope so.
Yeah. I listen. They do it all the time on podcasts as well. There's a podcast I listen to which is a really light-hearted, funny kind of sweary, risque podcast. But they do sometimes talk about serious subjects.
Yeah.
And when they do, they normally say trigger warning. We're about to talk about abortion or something like that, in case, you know, there are women that are listening to the podcast really enjoying themselves and suddenly they get a fright because they're talking about something that really makes them upset. So I think there is a place for them, but not
I mean, jokes aside for a minute, I think shouldn't we also sometimes feel upset? Shouldn't we sometimes be confronted with these emotions?
Definitely.
It's like trying to protect a child from ever falling or ever hurting themselves. Okay, so they never had a bruise. Great. And now they go on the street and the first thing knocks them over. They don't know how to deal with it. We are meant to sometimes feel upset. We are meant to sometimes cry over something. It's also part of healing.
Yes.
To confront it, to no longer have to hide behind trigger warnings. I mean, we are just putting ourselves in like, what's the next step? Lock yourself in the room and never leave. That's what they have in Japan, you know, the millions of people who don't leave the house anymore because they're too scared of anything.
Yes. Yeah, I totally agree. You know, the amount of times you're watching a film or a TV show and, you know, I'm really enjoying it and then something really sad happens and I'll cry, I'll react to it.
Good, you're human.
Exactly.
Well, you're supposed to react
exactly.
To it.
And sometimes I'll pause it and my husband and I will have a little kind of discussion and I'll express my emotion of being upset and why it upset me, you know, what it reminded me of or whatever. You know, wipe my tears away, press play and carry on. And it feels kind of good to be able to, you know, express your emotions, which, as you say, is good for you. You know, sometimes he'll say, you sure you're all right watching this, you know, if it's about something that obviously connects to me personally. And 99% of the time I will say, yeah, absolutely. Because it's exactly as you said, it's okay to be upset by what I'm watching. And healthy. I feel like it's healthy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, say, you know, movie, music, everything, all there to create an emotion.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't get an emotion from it, it's probably not worth watching or listening to.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we better take another break.
Hannah Murray. TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Steve Holmes and Percy Rowland. This is an article that we talked about last week on Women Talk, and I saved it in case we could get any funny stories or things that you can relate to. The headline reads, people are sharing the weird house rules they grew up with that they thought were completely normal until they left home. So it's things like, we had to wear socks at all times to keep the carpet clean. They weren't allowed to go on barefoot on the carpet. One, which is brilliant, not being allowed to get the bath mat wet. What's it for? How would you do that? So no locked doors ever. Never allowed to lock the door. This was a good one. I have to share this one. My mum had a strict rule about me not being allowed to eat at anyone's house. She was convinced that if I accepted an invite for dinner, it would make it look like she couldn't afford to feed me. It just became normal to say no if someone invited me to dinner. That was until I met the man who would be my ex-husband. His family kept inviting me over to dinner so that they could get to know me. I kept saying no. They thought I was rude. I finally explained why. That was when I realised it wasn't normal. Can you imagine all those years later? So can you think of anything, kind of house rules that you had to abide by that seemed totally normal because it was your house and your parents? And I couldn't think of
it. Not really. It's a difficult one, that.
It is a really difficult one, isn't it?
I'm trying to decide which one.
Percy's got a list.
No jeans, for example, is a good one.
Wow.
My father liked...
In the house or just
in general.
Ever?
My father liked to pretend the modern world didn't exist. And so one of his bugbears was jeans. which he thought were, you know, not appropriate to wear unless you were a labourer or something. So why would you?
Brilliant.
I think I wore my first pair of jeans. I was in my 20s, probably.
Yeah.
I also, like, for a long time, it seemed to me like, now, why would you wear them? Why is everybody wearing them?
Yeah, because it rubs off. Well, it goes one or two ways, doesn't it? Either rubs off on you or you,
I've grown,
you know,
quite
rebel.
Fond of them. Yeah, no, but it's funny, you know, like, I'm trying to think. I'm sure there were many others.
Yeah,
but that's the first one that came to mind.
Yeah, no jeans.
Is that
amazing.
Why all your black and white photographs, so you've got short trousers on?
Yeah, exactly.
So you're 21.
Okay, this has a lot of things that made me smile and laugh. 14 admirable traits of boomers, baby boomers, that prove they're a dying breed. Boomers get a lot of flack, but let's be honest, there are some things that they do better than anyone else. They grew up in a world that demanded resilience, patience, and self-sufficiency, and those traits have stuck with them. Unlike the convenience-driven mindset of today, boomers were raised with a different set of values, and many of those are slowly fading away. So some examples that we can look at. They always show up on time and with all their energy. Boomers don't believe in being fashionably late. If they agree to meet at 7, they'll be there at 6:55, probably wondering why no one else is as punctual as they are. They grew up in a time when running late meant you left someone standing outside in the cold, waiting with no way to contact you. 70% of baby boomers exhibit no tolerance for being late, highlighting their strong belief in punctuality as a sign of respect.
What age is a boomer, would you think?
Born kind of early 50s.
Late 40s, 50s.
Late 40s, early 50s.
I'm very punctual.
Yep.
Yeah, always. I'd rather be early than 1 minute late.
Yeah.
That's all. And all sorts of things. Clean your shoes. Always have a handkerchief, but not used.
Really?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm punctual myself, and I think this is because my parents traditionally weren't.
Mm.
So it sort of made me really want to be.
Mm.
Which of course, my grandfather really was. I mean, he was always early, so maybe that affected my mum to be the opposite, because he was annoyingly early, like a kind of 20-minute early type, need.
Yeah.
So that probably affected her to go the opposite, which affected me to go the opposite way. How are you with punctuality, Percy?
Pretty bad. I'm a punctual person trapped in the body of a very unpunctual person. So I suffer the most. People don't believe me. It's true.
I think I told you our wedding started 2 hours earlier than it did to make sure you were there on time.
It worked.
It did.
No, I'm similar. My father was similar. Now, the ironic thing is my father was German and my mother is Spanish. And you know what the stereotypes are. And in our case, they're the exact reverse. Because my mother is very punctual.
Okay.
And my grandfather was extremely punctual. He was that sort of person. 1 hour early to the train station, just in case the train came early, you know. You're already
there.
Yeah.
I can relate to that
And my father was, we used to joke that he would be late for his own funeral.
Yeah.
And it kind of came true because we still have his ashes at home. So, no, but I don't like, for me, okay, I think punctuality is important, and I think we should aim to be punctual. I think there is it's also rude to be early and then to expect somebody else to be early as well. That really annoys me. I think 5 minutes is okay.
Late, you mean?
5 minutes late is okay. Anything beyond that, I expect a message or a call that you're running a bit late, and I will always do that.
Mm.
And anything that's beyond, say, 15 or 20 minutes, I think, come on, then reschedule. But what I didn't think about why there is such a big divide about this is, of course, you know, we didn't have the technology in the past to message somebody.
Exactly.
So you were really standing there like a lemon. What happened? You know, is he turning up or not?
Mm.
So, and that is what really still annoys me. Like, you know, now we have this technology. At least
there's
tell
no
me.
Excuse.
There is
yeah.
no excuse. And I think it's very rude. One thing is, and it can happen to anyone, the best intentions, you can be late. But then at least tell me so we can either, you know, adapt or find another appointment.
Yeah, there's no excuse to not let people know. But funnily enough, we were discussing this on Good Morning Spain a couple of weeks ago, talking about the fact of a cultural thing. Mm. And you have to respect and understand the cultural differences of the country that you're living in and call home. Mm. So as, you know, and I'm completely generalizing here, but as a culture, you know, that the British are more punctual than the Spanish. You know, there's the sort of mañana attitude and being late is, this is what we were saying on the program, is totally normal and accepted and absolutely okay. And we, living in their country, cannot expect them to be more what we expect and what we demand because we're in their country. So it's, you have to adapt and understand that it's a cultural thing. It's not rudeness. It's.
But here's the thing. I find that a lot of this, it's true until it's not. So Spain has this image of being, you know, very laid back and very easygoing and so on. I find it can also be one of the most strict countries in so many ways. And if you deal with bureaucracy or something, if you have an appointment at 12:52, it's at 12:52. If you're not there at 12:52, okay, two things can happen. Either the 10 appointments before you have not gone through yet because everything is running 2 hours late.
Yeah.
Or you arrive and said, oh, it already was a minute ago. You lost your slot, you know? So it's unpredictable.
Yes, yes. Interesting.
I find it very stressful being late.
I do.
If I'm sat in a queue or I can't get to where I'm supposed to be, and like you said, I'll make a text message and say, I'm sorry, I'm running late or whatever, but I find that really stressful.
Yeah.
I find it a lot easier to be 15 minutes early and wait around the corner.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't like being late.
I agree with that. The thing is just I have literally no feeling for time in that sense. Like I always overestimate the time I still have. So I think I've got 40 minutes. It takes me 20 minutes to get there. So I've still got 20 minutes to do something. I can still do this and this. And I underestimate the amount of time these tasks will take. And suddenly half an hour has passed. Oh, damn. I'm 10 minutes late.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it takes planning to be on time. It takes forward planning and organisation and being aware of how... I had to be at a friend's house this morning at 10:30 and there were a few kind of errands that I wanted to do beforehand. I did one of them and I was finished by 10:15 and I thought, I'm not going to have time to do another one and get there for 10:30. So I went straight to hers and I was 6 minutes early, you know, which was fine. But I figured that was better than being 6 minutes late.
Yeah, because that 12 minutes late, you'd been stressed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I would have felt bad we would have had less time and Okay, they never arrive at an event empty-handed. If a boomer is invited to a dinner party, you can bet they're showing up with something in hand, whether it's a bottle of wine, a homemade casserole, or a small bouquet they believe in contributing to the occasion.
Definitely.
Yeah. But, I mean, I'd do that, and I'm not a boomer. I think that's just politeness. Yeah?
Yeah, bottle of wine.
It's always a bottle of wine because I tend to forget after that I'm going there.
That sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're going to someone's house for dinner, I would always take a bottle of wine, some chocolate.
I like after dinner mints as well, so taking them is like always a great idea.
Yes, exactly. Let's have these for dessert. Yeah. Yes.
Bring along what you would like to have.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting one. We were discussing this the other day. If you were... going to someone's house for dinner, would you take, if you're taking wine, for example, would you take a wine that you're expecting to drink? Would you give them something and kind of say, oh, you know, this is for you, have it another time? Would you take something that you maybe want to get rid of from your house that you don't want to drink in the hope that they don't open it? What would you generally do?
Well, if you look at it from the other side of the coin, when somebody brings a bottle of wine to you, you look at it and think, that's really great. I hope we don't need to open that one tonight. You know, it's one of my favourites. So it's just like a double-edged sword. So I don't know. You would expect to drink it, I guess.
Yeah, I would take a nice one. But I often find if you've had a party and then you've got lots of people coming that are bringing beers and wines and things like that, if you have anything left over, it could be that you have some left over that you wouldn't want to drink. You know, that's happened to me multiple times. And then it stays in the fridge for absolutely ages because you're not going to drink it. And you kind of have the discussion, what do we do with this wine? And I generally wait until we're going to a party and we're taking multiple drinks. And then you think, oh, well, we'll take this one and hopefully take someone else will drink it.
Ooh, so that's where that plonk came from that's in my fridge.
But that's quite a good idea because hopefully... If you're going to a party, whether there's going to be lots of people, it's more likely that someone will go, oh, you know, I like that wine.
Will not realise who it's from.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're kind of wine snobs, so...
We had somebody notorious for that. They used to come to a party and bring the bottle of wine and put it in the corner and then attack the wine
that was in the... The more expensive ones.
And the bottle of plonk was always in the corner at the end, you know, nobody ever drunk it.
So, yeah. Oh, no, that's not nice. You have to bring a selection. We've got one more ad break. We'll be back on this subject after this.
Hannah Murray, TRE in the afternoon.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the last part of Men Talk. With me in the studio today is Steve Holmes and Percy Rowland. Had a couple of messages in, one from Rabina, who said, I also had the problem not to wear jeans. So there you go.
I wasn't alone.
No. Max said, trigger warnings on ITV4 for dated episodes of The Sweeney and Minder in the 70s and 80s. Spoils the atmosphere. Very silly. Yeah.
The only trigger warnings on that should be the hairdos.
Yes, quite. Exactly. Okay, we're going through some of the things featured on an article, 14 admirable traits of boomers that prove they're a dying breed. This is baby boomers. Put in a positive light. They have sharp attention spans, a virtue lost in the digital age. Boomers didn't grow up in a world of constant notifications, scrolling and split-second entertainment. They read books cover to cover, sat through full conversations without checking their watches, and actually focused on the task in front of them. Yes. Go on, Percy.
Am I a boomer? Well, I grew up a boomer, definitely. I actually grew up just before, childhood, before the digital age. So, I mean, we had the first mobile phone in 2000, I think. And of course, that was just a phone. You couldn't do anything else. Okay, you could text with it, you know. Two 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 four four five six 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 six. You know, to get the letter that you wanted, and then we bought a computer around that time, but it had no internet until early 2000s. I was using it, very little. So,
but how much have mobile phones taken over our lives now?
Oh, completely.
You know, the idea of sitting through a full conversation without checking their watches. It says here. So often you can be having a conversation with someone and it can be a great conversation. You're, you know, looking at each other, you're engaged, and easily without even thinking about it, you or they could just, you know, pick up the phone and have a little glance instead of being completely engaged. You know, what's going to happen whether you've been messaged or not? You know, people easily, I've done it myself and I see people doing it all the time, you know, have to check your phone instead of being completely with the conversation.
I have done it at least 8 or 9 times in the course of this show.
I'm
not sure if you notice, but
I do notice.
It's an addiction. It's an absolute addiction.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's lots of studies about it. I mean, this is the most addictive thing we have. Because every time, it's funny, yesterday I just did a speech about that. It's dopamine. Every time the thing is dopamine, you get a dopamine kick also in anticipation of something. So there is the first one when you pick up the phone, think, I wonder if I have a message, or I wonder what's up there. Is there something new? Is there a new cat video on Instagram? Then you open it, and then it's the dopamine hit of finding the cat video, or finding in the meantime, oh, I have a notification on WhatsApp. Oh, Hannah sent me a message not to be late for the show. Or this. Every time it's a little hit, and that is exactly the same area of the brain that gets activated when people take cocaine. And that's why it's so addictive.
Mm.
And, you know, I have my average screen time. Okay, I use it a lot for work as well. And
that's a great excuse that people hide behind,
it is a great excuse. Well, everybody I know who does real estate is in the same boat. But my average screen time is about 6-7 hours a day on the phone. I also use a laptop.
Okay.
But I try not to use it. But
yeah, that's a lot, it's
bad.
Isn't it?
It's bad. It's a full working day.
Mm.
And the effect it has on our attention spans, on our mental health, when you look at depression rates in especially Western countries, how they have multiplied since in the last sort of 15 years, which is since we use smartphones. If you look at how politics have developed all over the world, it's all correlated.
Mm. Steve, do you use your phone a lot?
I'll never open the phone again after listening to that. It's very difficult to remember not having a phone.
Yeah.
Ever, you know?
Yeah.
And the number of times you used to meet people and you arranged to meet at 7 o'clock and you had no idea whether they were going to turn up or not. And you waited and eventually it turned up. But you had no way of contacting people.
No.
But those times are impossible to remember.
Telephone booths.
But do you use your phone a lot now? Do you?
Yeah, for stuff that is really probably irrelevant most of the time. You know? I think making a phone call is probably the last thing you use it for.
Yes.
You know?
Which is amazing, isn't it? You use it a lot for internet and things like
internet,
that?
Yeah, internet, checking something, you know, or somebody will say, I wonder how old that actress is or how old that footballer is or whatever.
So you look it up.
You've got the instant answer.
Because interestingly, you said earlier that you don't use social media. So
no,
even not being on social media, you're still on your phone
which is
interesting.
I think it was a podcast actually the other day about that social media no longer exists, actually. They no longer are social media. They are, you know, because the last thing you see is posts from your friends. You know, Facebook 10 years ago, you saw posts from your friends all the time and you had conversations. And it was a bit like the digital version of like the bar.
What's that thing?
Or the bar in Friends or, where everybody sort of gathers and chats and makes jokes and so on.
Yeah.
And posts their pictures on a wall, which is kind of weird. And everybody looks at them and gives likes. But, you know, it was still that sort of thing.
More interactive.
And now it's just suggested post after suggested post and group after group. And, you know, Instagram is the same thing. And it's flooding you with content, which is designed to get you hooked to look at more content and then maybe to subscribe to something that they make money from.
Definitely.
It's attention media, they called it, rather than social media.
We've got less than a minute left. Just to say, my friend and I were talking about this morning, how much of a sucker we both are for buying things online because clearly they're big brother, they're hearing you, they're hearing what you're talking about, they know what you're interested in, and then you get the targeted adverts that make you go, oh, that looks nice, that's exactly what I'm looking for, I need one of those.
Sometimes they get it wrong. This morning I got an advert that says, where to have sex in Norway. I did not mention Norway ever. Norway.
Clarifying just the Norway. Thank you both very much for coming in today. Thank you to Steve Holmes and Percy Rowland for a great show. Howard Brereton is coming up next with Spain Today. Have a great weekend. I'm actually on tomorrow morning with Giles at 10:30 to talk about my upcoming India trip. So I'll see you then.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.